So I think overall the seventh season of The Next Generation was fairly successful, and then we got All Good Things, which was a fantastic end to the series. You're really pumped. You're excited for the first Next Generation movie. They're graduating into the motion picture universe. They're going to be like pushing it forward after The Undiscovered Country, and we get Generations.
And you know something? I was expecting to hate this. You know, other than the fact that it obviously had a larger budget than, you know, a regular episode, it was a slightly bigger in terms of the plot and all of that. You have the Kirk, you know, and all of that. But generally, it felt like a two-parter season finale, you know, premiere. This was, you know, to me, this episode was almost along the lines of Time's Arrow. Like, it kind of felt like that in that... It had some good moments. It was a big adventure, you know, but it wasn't, it's not one of the best of the series. It's certainly not one of the best movies. That said, for an episode of The Next Generation that I could have seen in the theater, it was good, you know?
No, I know what you mean.
I think, was it you who said that, like, generally the movies for Next Generation are like a big TV episode? I mean, that's kind of how the original series movies felt like movies. This didn't really feel like a movie.
Well, I guess, okay, so I want a little clarification of what exactly you mean by it didn't feel like a movie. Because to me, I think that it structurally wouldn't have worked as a two-parter.
No.
I think that structurally, I think it does feel like a movie. So I think that there's much more of a case to be made for something like another Next Generation movie, which I'm thinking of, which I won't say because I don't want to prejudice you. But then again, we're not going to be recording that episode for like 6 years, so maybe you won't remember. But, you know, to me, it definitely, they try and make it a bit more epic in scope. They try and make it a bit more, you know, they've got this whole 15 or 20 minute opening sequence with Kirk, Scotty, and Chekhov. Then they sort of transition into the Next Generation universe. There's a lot of stuff there, and I don't think that...
I mean, there were, you know...
I don't know.
It wasn't as, you know, certainly this would... I can see this, you know, the movie is going downhill, but this isn't as good as the original series movies, five accepted.
Well, I think the what you're trying to get at, you know, and correct me if I'm interpreting you incorrectly, but I think that what you're saying is when you try and serve multiple characters in a movie, it feels a lot more like a television episode than the Next Generation movies, which were very much a through line about like one or two characters. And really, if you look at the original series movies, the first movie was probably the weakest because it didn't really have a focal character.
Yeah.
The second one was definitely the focal character being Kirk. The third one, the focal character is really Spock. The fourth one, that's a little weird, but I think you
could
argue
that. But it's a little more ensemble-y, but...
Right, but it's kind of the, you know, and that's kind of the one that feels a bit more like a TV movie, I think. And then you sort of get to the sixth one, which is, again, very much like plot-driven. I think the problem with Generations...
Yeah, the sixth is still my favorite of the thing, and it's very Kirk story in that one, too, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the problem with Generations is, frankly, that the movie doesn't know what it's about.
Yeah.
Like, is it about Picard dealing with the fact that he's never been able to have a family and a wife? Is it about Data getting these emotions? Is it about Sorin? You know, is it about this kind of idea of the Nexus? Is it about bridging the gap between generations and sort of like passing the torch? What is this
movie
about?
Is it about Kirk dealing with the fact that he didn't have a family because that, you know, turns out to be a thing of his? And yeah, we've seen how Kirk deals with retirement. In a way, I guess I kind of felt like a lot of the Kirk stuff felt redundant in a way. You know, the six original series movies was about how Kirk deals with retirement and how he, you know, gets from the fact that he's been promoted to admiral and he's bored and now he's doing all these things that are dealing with the repercussions of his career. And finally, you know, when you have Star Trek VI, it does feel like he resolved everything, you know, in a way. From a movie perspective, he's still going to have adventures and stuff like that. He's still going to have things to do, but... It felt like Kirk's arc was finished, and now it kind of felt like it's taking a step or two back.
Well, I would agree with that, and I think that one of the problems with Generations as a movie is that I don't think that you know, okay, so Ronald D. Moore and Brian Braga wrote this. And so I don't know that they necessarily felt like... It feels to me like they weren't comfortable enough on the strength of the Next Generation cast to really sell the movie. I think that, you know, maybe they wanted to kind of like make it a very epic story in scope and say, okay, we're definitely making an explicit transition between the original series crew and the Next Generation crew into these motion pictures. I don't know that you needed to do that. I think that, you know, one of the things that we talked about a lot, you know, in the latter part of the Next Generation episodes of Trek about is that Next Generation was Star Trek at this point. Yeah, it didn't have anything to prove. And so,
the torch had already been passed in a way.
Right.
If this had been, you know, if they had done a movie like this for, you know, as the pilot, if this had been the pilot for Star Trek The Next Generation, it may, you know, obviously you would need to do some tweaks, but it might be a very different one. This is a literal passing of the torch from Kirk to this new Captain Picard that we're just meeting and dealing with.
Well,
it's just
interesting to me because, you know, if you look at the whole construction of The Next Generation, we've talked about this before, but I think this is a perfect opportunity to sort of revisit that idea, is that they were very, very wary of bringing up anything about the original series characters in the first couple seasons of The Next Generation, and I think rightly so. Because that would have made the series really reliant on, you know, the ratings are sagging, let's bring in Uhura. Oh, the ratings are sagging, let's mention Kirk, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think it was a really smart decision to say, no, we want this show to stand on its own, and we want this show to succeed or fail on its own merits. Once they had done that, and once they had succeeded, they started bringing in, you know, they brought in Spock and Unification. They brought in Scotty and Relics. You know, aside from the McCoy cameo and encounter at Farpoint, they didn't do anything like that. You know, Sarek in the third season.
Yeah, and all
right?
Really, you know, McCoy did was essentially just, you know, christen the ship and, you know, give his blessing and move on, you know?
Right. And so to me, it feels like, okay, they had, you know, after that, all that stuff, after, you know, The Undiscovered Country in 1991. This is the only Star Trek now. This is it. I mean, Deep Space Nine was in the works, and we'll be talking about Deep Space Nine starting next week. But that's the weird thing to me is, like, it seems to be going a step back, and it seems to be saying, oh, we really need to make sure that people understand that this is still Star Trek, and so we're going to put Kirk in it. And I'm not sure why.
Like, there is a degree. So I knew that this movie had Kirk in it. I knew that he dies at the end of the movie. I knew that it had something to do with the bridge, and I actually thought it meant, like, the bridge of the Enterprise. I thought he died on the bridge, because, I guess we will talk about how Kirk dies at some point in this.
Yeah.
I honestly thought that this was, you know, the entire movie was an adventure with Picard and Kirk, you know? I thought the entire point of the movie was, you know, something, you know, people have been arguing, you know, oh, who's the better captain, Picard or Kirk? Well, we're going to team them up together and, you know, they're going to solve. And that would have been cool. I think that would have been kind of just let's have a movie with Superman and Batman.
But that feels a lot more like fan service than Star Trek ever really does.
Well done fan service would not be a bad thing.
I don't want to watch it, though. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not interested in that whole Picard and Kirk thing and which one is the better captain. I'm interested in Star Trek telling good stories. And to me, if that was going to be a good story, fantastic, I would be all over that movie. But to me, it's like they come up with this sort of a gimmick that doesn't necessarily need to be in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we'll talk about Data and the Emotion Chip, but I think
we have to.
Well, I mean, yeah, we want to be a comprehensive Star Trek podcast, Richard. I think that's really the case. This movie feels like a collection of gimmicks.
Yeah, there's...
And, I mean, even to the point where William Shatner's performance in this movie, I mean, let's be honest, it's almost as though he's playing a caricature of Kirk.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like Kirk.
He's phoning it in a lot of ways.
Right.
Yeah, it's... Yeah.
And so, to me, you know, Ronald D. Moore and Brian Braga had this idea, and they were like, let's put Kirk in this movie, and oh, what if we kill him? That would be, you know... it just seems to me like two writers in love with their own ideas and not really thinking through the consequences of any of this, if it would be interesting on screen, if it would make any sort of sense, if it would be satisfying, or if it would serve any purpose in the movie. And I don't really see that Kirk dying in this movie adds anything to the movie, adds anything to the themes of the movie, the plot of the movie, any of that.
Especially in the way it does. It's not like, you know, at the end of, you know, Star Trek, the motion picture when what's-his-name merges with V'ger at the end, you know, when you have all of that. Like, if Kirk had died in that kind of a manner, a grandiose, transcendent manner that, you know, what he's figured out to do. I mean, because, yes, you know, we need to, if we want to see the end point of the Kirk story, which is he, you know, dies in action and figures out. That's fine. But this seemed too, I don't know. I guess it's because the plot of the episode, the villain's plan, all of that was stupid.
Right.
And therefore, it didn't really, this is what killed Kirk in a way. Like, I guess that was part of it.
Well, yeah, and there's that. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think that the idea of, oh, well, maybe Kirk doesn't need to die in a grandiose fashion. Maybe he just dies. And it's like,
no, but
yeah, okay, I get
that didn't work with Tasha Yar. Like, we already learned that. And that was just Tasha Yar, who was a, you know, secondary character that we had for one season. And, you know, we all realized, shit, that wasn't a really, we didn't really, this is fucking Captain Kirk. Like, if I want to see Captain Kirk die, I want him dying in a blaze of glory and exploding the screen and holy shit. Like, it should have been a scene that, you know, people would have talked about forever. And
right. I get the idea. Oh, death is not always noble. Death is not always beautiful. Death is, you know, all those kind of things. I don't care. I'm watching Star Trek. I want to see Captain Kirk die in a fashion which is befitting Captain Kirk. I don't want to see him get, you know, being killed by falling off a cliff.
Spock died at the end of Wrath of Khan in a very grandiose, glorious way, which, you know, especially hit the entire theme of that movie,
yeah,
that, you know, the needs of the many and all of that. Like, Spock's death was a literal depiction of that theme, which is running throughout the series and throughout the movie, and, you know, takes it in a direction that, you know, recognizes that is a much more difficult theme than, you know, it sounds on paper. You know, in other words, you can't, you know, you have to make that needs of the many, you know, works for yourself and all. And, you know, Spock's death illustrates that beautifully. I don't really know what Kirk's death signifies other than the fact that, you know, he's choosing riskier life over, you know, a safe illusion.
It's
whatever.
You know what it is? It's self-indulgent. It's Brannon Braga and Ronald Moore getting an idea that writers really fell in love with,
yeah,
and not thinking through what this would look like on screen. That's basically it is. They're like, we have the power to kill Captain Kirk, so we're going to do it.
And it's, but,
like,
you got to use it responsibly.
Well, right, exactly. And again, I mean, this really gets into, you know, let's talk about kind of the plot of the movie and, like, what this movie is about. Because, again, to me, I don't really know what the movie is about.
It's a very weak plot, yeah.
I don't think that they had any idea of what kind of themes they were really working with here. Maybe some of this is due to the fact that they're not used to writing movies. I don't know. But it does feel very episodic in a certain sense. I'm going back on myself a little bit because I do think it feels like a movie, but I also think that there are weird parts to it which just feel very episodic.
I mean, I guess part of it is that, again, you think about the villains from the, you know, Star Trek movies, and we've had some, again, Khan is, of course, the greatest one, you know, but, you know, even V'ger is a very striking, you know, entity. What's his name from Star Trek VI, you know. You have a lot of these, you know, hell, even the God being from 5 is a weird light show, you know. I never quite understood what Soren's motivation was, why I should care about him. He's gonna destroy people for a reason, and, you know, it's bad and he wants to, like, who cares? That was a degree of it. Like, I couldn't care about stopping this guy because he was a very uninteresting villain.
And you can see them kind of lining the pieces up, and they're just not quite fitting together.
This movie, like, is very less than the sum of its parts.
Oh, absolutely. I think that there are parts of it that I really like, and I think there are parts of it that are absolutely horrible. And also, I think that this movie is the warning, you know, the canary in the coal mine, in a sense, about what the Next Generation movies are going to be about. But we can talk about that later. One of the things that I think is very weak about the movie is I can see what they were trying to do. They come up with this idea of the Nexus, right? It's basically heaven, okay?
Yeah.
And, of course, you want, if you're sucked out of heaven, you want to get back to heaven.
I mean, I took that more of it as a, you know, addiction metaphor in a lot of ways.
That's interesting.
Soren is a junkie who just wants to get high, basically, and he doesn't really care who he hurts in that pursuit.
Huh.
He's just gotten this bliss, and he's been taken out of this bliss, and he's going to – again, he's basically going to – he's a heroin addict who's going to steal his parents', you know, TV to sell
it.
But, you know, I guess they didn't really clearly make enough what the Nexus is. In a way, it's supposed to be just – it is a very literal MacGuffin in this movie.
I don't think it matters. I think it's heaven. It's your perfect moment.
It's whatever. It's again, it's a MacGuffin. It's whatever you want.
But. Right. But I think that that's kind of what it is that they come up with this idea, yeah. and they say, okay, we're gonna sort of like construct the entire movie around this idea of the Nexus. It's basically heaven in space. People want to get back to it. Soren wants to get back to it. Guinan was sucked out of it. Okay, fine, whatever. They sort of go into that a little bit because you've got the beginning of the movie, right? Which talks about Captain Harriman, who is obviously not very good at his job.
Well, he's interesting. I we'll talk about him in a second because I find him. I find that I liked the intro sequence a lot. But continue.
We'll talk about Captain Ferris Bueller later.
Yeah.
So you already have
oh my God, that's who it is.
Yeah. That's Cameron from Ferris Bueller.
Okay, I knew I recognized him, but okay.
So the movie already starts out with the idea that this is Kirk's destiny. This is what Kirk does best. This is what Kirk likes to do. Kirk doesn't feel alive anywhere else but on the bridge of a starship. Okay? He goes out. He saves the starship. That's a fantastic ending for Kirk, right? He's sucked out into space. It's very sad, but he went out in the performance of his duties, and he saved the ship, and he saved 47 lives. Okay, that's fine. Then we cut to 78 years later, the Enterprise D with the bizarre, fetish, I don't know, like, what the fuck is that even? Wooden sailing ship.
Oh, thing. Yeah. Like what?
I don't know what that was. It was fine. I guess the implications that they were always doing this when they were promoting people, which, all right.
They're trying to half-ass that, Starfleet as the Navy that they did a bit in the original series movies, but that was never really it fits awkwardly with
that whole scene. To me, feels like the script was short by 10 pages
and they had a bunch of costumes around and a ship set. Yeah.
I don't know. That was expensive to do too. I don't know. So you get this idea that, okay, they're setting this up. Picard finds out that his brother and his nephew have burned to death in a fire. Yeah. Which is like, what? Okay, so that starts him on this journey of, sitting in the dark, emo-like, and contemplating the fact that he never had a family, he never had a wife, he's very sad about this. Number one, we can talk about this. I don't know that I buy that, but okay.
That was definitely, a couple of seasons ago, I felt that that would have been more, more relevant for Picard to have as a theme, but it's in a way he's kind of dealt with all of that by now.
I think so. So I get it. They're setting up Kirk. They're setting up Picard, saying they're kind of, these are their best destinies, but at the same time, they have some of these doubts. So you enter the Nexus. The Nexus is this idea that you're going to be able to live out your perfect fantasy, et cetera, et cetera. But you don't really want that because life is messy and but it doesn't ever really link up. There's no sense that they're really trying to come up with a best destiny or a fantasy destiny for these characters that makes much sense. Picard's destiny is living in a Christmas carol.
Yeah.
And Kirk's destiny is making breakfast for his wife. Like, and to me, it's just like, what is going on here? I don't know. I don't get it.
Yeah. Like even arguing the fact that, Picard knows exactly what he's getting into in a way that the others don't, like, it doesn't seem worth destroying suns for. Do you know what I mean? Like, which I guess is part of why I took it as an addiction metaphor, because a non-addict cannot understand that desire to a degree and will think it's kind of stupid and this facile illusion. But again, I don't think the movie has deep enough of an understanding of psychology to justify that theme in a way.
Okay, we'll expand on that a little bit.
No, it just seems like there is no particular rhyme or, like I said, the Nexus doesn't seem cool enough that, Picard doesn't really seem that tempted for that long with it,
And
the temptation, they don't sell that Picard is having to work really hard to break out of this. They don't sell that,
And there's two things there. I think number one, that goes back to a long motion picture tradition of it's just really, really hard to do heaven on screen and it always looks lame.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's number one. I think number two is they made a mistake in showing the Nexus. I don't think they should have shown it. I think what you do with that is you show Picard lying in his bed going, like that kind of thing. You don't actually show what he's singing because there's no way that that is going to be as good as what we're imagining is going on in our own mind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so you can sub in whatever you think.
And hell, he could even have a speech where he said, I was with my family. I saw my nephew, and all of that. And, Patrick Stewart will be able to sell that as, you know, we can get the rest of that in our heads. Yeah.
Right. Right. And so, yeah, I get you. I get that. You know, it's interesting you say it's an addiction metaphor. So where do you take that, though? Do you think that that's something that was explicit in the movie? I didn't pick up on that, so I'm curious about what.
No, I think part of that is just my, you know, personal interest in, you know, where I take themes in my own writing and everything like that. I guess it's, you know, I think if you had, you know, if you asked Ronald Moore and Brandon Braga what the Nexus represents, you know, they would probably say it's heaven, it's paradise, it's, you know, your heart's desire, you know, it's all of those.
Yeah.
You know, again, but again, maybe addiction isn't quite the right word, obsession, but it's clear that Soren, again, feels this physical need for this Nexus that is beyond reason, beyond rational. At this point, I think he may even know that, you know, what you see is an illusion. He's not really going to see his wife and child. I think he knows that. And yet, it doesn't really matter because, you know, this is good enough, and he's willing to do anything to get to it.
And yeah, and I think, frankly, part of the problem with that is that we don't get a good sense of Soren as a character.
Yeah.
I don't know what motivates him, really. I don't know who he is. And,
you know, maybe that's characterizes. He's characterized like an insane junkie in a way.
He kind of is, yeah. I mean, he even kind of looks like a
that's his entire entire personality. We don't even, again, we get no sense of who he is, and he's not an effective villain. He's not an interesting villain. I'm not.
But I think it's a problem that you're characterizing him as a villain. I think that the movie would be more interesting if he wasn't.
Well, I guess that's fair. Like, this movie just sees him as somebody who's making a bad decision, and while we may understand, you know, that to a little degree, he is dead wrong, and he is cackling, and he kills Captain, you know, and he, yeah, and yeah, if they had made him three-dimensional, you know, because again, Khan is the villain of Wrath of Khan, but he is a three-dimensional villain.
Sure,
you know? He's a villain.
Sure.
You know, villains are the ones we sympathize with and like and love seeing on screen, and I don't give a shit about Soren.
We know what motivates Khan. We know who he is. We know all of those things about him. We don't know anything about Soren. And I think that, you know, you're supposed to fill in the blanks with a lot of the information about Guinan, what she's told Picard and other characters on the ship about her experiences with the Borg, for example. You know, and I get it. You know, you're supposed to fill in the gaps, and you're supposed to say, well, Soren lived on their planet, and the Borg attacked. He was able to escape somehow, and his wife and child were killed by the Borg. Okay, that's pretty terrible. But at the same time, I don't really get a sense of what happened, why this was, you know, such a traumatic event for him, where he was, how he managed to survive. Did he see them actually get killed?
Yeah.
Did he not? Was he off planet? Is that how they were surviving? There's no sense of really sort of like trying to, you know, give a persona to this species, because we find out what species Guinan is for the first time.
Yeah.
They're Elorians. All right. And so I think that there's a lot of really interesting things that they could have done with this. I mean, Guinan isn't really a big part of this either, and I find that weird.
Yeah.
Because I think that Guinan in the movie would have been a very, very interesting thing. And, of course, you get that sort of, like, echo of her in the Nexus, which makes absolutely no sense.
I mean, I was super excited to see Guinan, because, again, we had, you know, I thought it was a shame that she wasn't in All Good Things, you know, when they could have easily put her, you know, somewhere.
Sure.
They were in the bar at one point, you know, she could have still been, you know, but, you know, I was excited to see her, but they don't really do much with her.
No.
And, you know, let me put it this way. She reveals that, yes, I was in the Nexus and I have tried my damnedest to forget about it because it was that good. I don't feel like that gives us any insight to Guinan's character, and it doesn't necessarily, like, again, I'll maybe rewatch an episode or two with her in it, but I don't think that was exactly in the back of her mind during those events. Now, obviously, they hadn't written this episode yet, you know, this movie yet. They hadn't come up with the concept of the Nexus, but kind of feels pulled from nowhere. It doesn't seem right, like that's a part of who she is.
Well, yeah, and think about Dark Page from the seventh season, for example, where we find out that Loaxana Troi had this other daughter that was drowned. And, you know, we both really liked that episode, and I was kind of saying there that I think that adds a lot of, like, that's how you retcon a character, right? Like, it gives a lot of different shades to the way that they act.
Yeah, her personality is so larger than life because she's avoiding her feelings, because she's trying to deny, you know, and all of
She's so overprotective of Deanna because she had a daughter who died. All of these things make a lot of sense in context once you see that episode.
She doesn't want to be alone because she remembers her dead daughter all the time. You know, that's why she's always hunting for people. Yeah, that made all made sense.
This doesn't – you're right. This whole Nexus experience doesn't make any sense in terms of Guinan's character. It doesn't give us any information about who she is as a person. And I'm not even sure why they would want to get back to it so badly. I mean, that's the other part where, again, they're just not selling this idea that the Nexus is anything that great.
Yeah, I want to, you know, back to the point you said earlier about, you know, his wife and child died. I'm really curious about how in 70 years, how he did not manage to get over that. Do you know what I mean? Like, I especially if he's coming from this race of people who are good at listening, you know, and all of that.
Not only that, good at listening, but also they live a really long time.
Yeah, like you would think that, you know, well, yes, I can dig that this would be a traumatic event that would take you a while to get over and that you would do some crazy things over. I don't know. Doesn't it seem like Star Trek is the kind of show that would make, I don't know, like he seems irredeemable and he seems unable to get over that grief. And that doesn't seem like what Star Trek is, in a way.
I would agree with that. And I think that what we've seen of obsessed characters in Star Trek in the past, and I'm thinking about, for example, Kruge from Star Trek 3 and Wrath of Khan, you know, Khan from Star Trek 2.
Yeah.
These are characters that are obsessed, but they're not illogical. And they're not taking these extreme actions to get something back. I mean, frankly, the fact that Soren is willing to wipe out an entire pre-industrial civilization just in order to get back to the Nexus strikes me as so over-the-top supervillainy as to not be able to take it seriously.
Yeah, yeah, going from regular villainy to cartoonish supervillainy,
And so I'm not sure I'm not even sure what this movie is trying to say about that, and I don't think there's anything to say about it. I think that it's just, they thought it was a cool idea and they didn't think through the logical ramifications of it. In a lot of ways, I think Star Trek The Next Generation doesn't scale up to a movie very well.
I think that could be fair. I don't know. Again, seeing the, because again, something like Best of Both Worlds, like, yes, it would need to be restructured and all of that, but that could have worked as a movie, you know, all good things. Again, structure it a little differently. That could have worked as a movie. You know, there are things that, you know, there are episodes that I think could have worked with a larger scope, that suggests that a larger scope could have worked.
Yeah.
But this isn't it.
Well, I think it's a problem that when the movie starts, I think that you kind of feel a little bit relieved that Captain Kirk is there. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like, oh, this is interesting. Okay, Captain Kirk's here. The adult's here. I feel like this is going to be a good movie. You know, we haven't really talked about the beginning of the movie, but I think let's talk about it. So, What did you make of that entire opening sequence?
See, I think it's interesting because, you know, you say, oh, yeah, the captain's incompetent. I think I found him and Kirk's dynamic to be very interesting because, number one, he's obviously scared shitless that Captain Kirk is on the bridge, you know, on
There's
his
reporters
bridge.
On the bridge.
Yeah, you know, this is a big media thing, and the ship isn't even fucking ready. Like, you know, as he goes, you know, I mean, it's almost a running joke through the thing. But, I mean, you know, we learn that as – but the second he goes on the ship, he knows the ship is not ready for any disaster that happens to it. And as he realizes that this is the only disaster and that he is under very specific scrutiny, again, both from some legendary people within Starfleet and from, you know, reporters, everything he knows is going to be, you know, looked at.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, I like the way that Kirk teaches him because he's obviously itching to go. He's obviously itching to just take charge and stuff. And but he waits till the other captain, you know, asks for his help. And, you know, he immediately is decisive. But I think it's interesting that Kirk is kind of teaching him. And he basically says, like, you know, basically Kirk's interaction is, you need to be more decisive. You know, you need to figure this out. You know, this is, if you're in this seat, if you're the captain, you got to step up.
Right,
you know, and he's, which, but I think he does it in a way which, you know, you know, helps his confidence and empowers him, but rather than saying, you know, look, you earned this, you can do this, you can't be nervous, you know, this
right,
is...
Right, right.
And, you know, I think it is interesting when, you know, he tells, you know, Captain Kirk, oh, I'll do it, you have the bridge, and Kirk says, no, I'll go, you know, because he does realize that, no, this is his bridge.
Like, yeah.
You know, as much as Kirk wants to be on the bridge of a starship again, he knows this isn't his ship and it's not his place, but he can do this, you know. And I liked that.
I think one of the weaknesses of the opening, and I like the opening a lot, and I think the opening is probably my favorite part of the movie, is that I have a hard time placing exactly when this is supposed to be. You know, at the end of the Undiscovered Country, they're on the ship again, but there's the implication that the ship is going to be retired soon.
Yeah.
And they're all going to go off on their own way again. As it was sort of at the end of, Star Trek? Well, I guess the beginning of Star Trek, the motion picture was kind of like that too. So if you look at the first six movies of the Star Trek universe as being sort of the beginning and the end of the end of Kirk's retirement.
The last, yeah.
And then the beginning of Kirk's retirement again at the end of Star Trek VI. At this, it's sort of like trying to fill in the gaps a little bit about what exactly was going on then. So what you get, of course, is you get Kirk, Scotty, and Chekhov. And frankly, you know, I like the beginning of the movie a lot, but I think a lot of the dialogue is very generic, and which is a problem. I don't think that Scotty or Chekhov are really saying anything in particular that was very, very true to their characters.
Most of what they're doing is just snarking at Kirk good-naturedly, you know, but that's about it.
Right. And did they really do that? I don't know. I think that there's some weird things there. But that aside, you know, it works because it sets up kind of, I guess, the passing of the torch idea early on in the movie, and also sets up the idea of this newness and this sort of like freshness, and, you know, puts us in the past. Guinan's reveal is very shocking, of course, and then you sort of get into the future and suddenly it's this whole big thing. So I agree with you that I think that he's probably not as incompetent as perhaps I painted him out to be, but I think at the same time what's interesting about that is I don't know if I get a sense that his first best destiny is being a starship captain. And you have to remember too, like, this is the Enterprise B, right?
Yeah.
And at this point, I don't know that the Enterprise was considered the flagship of Starfleet. You know, this is just another Enterprise or having another one, but, you know, at this point it's kind of like, by the time you get to maybe the Enterprise C or the Enterprise D, that's more of a big deal to get the Enterprise. The Enterprise B is probably not that much of a big deal.
Yeah.
It's only a big deal because Kirk was the captain.
Yeah, and at this point also, Kirk and all of them are still alive and still, you know, very much figures within the Federation, you know. Kirk has trotted out for every, you know, thing like this. But, you know, yeah, once you get to Picard's time, it's much more of a legendary thing. It's much more of an honor, you know. You're serving on the same ship that Captain Kirk did, you know, and, you know, who's been, you know, who disappeared mysteriously 70 years ago in the service of duty, you know, so it becomes,
right.
You know, yeah, you're right. It perpetuates the honor. And as generations go, this is just, you know, kind of a, you know, he's not seen as the next Kirk in the same way that Picard may be.
Right. Exactly. But I think that kind of underscores some of the problem with the movie, which is just that it has too many characters to service. I mean, you have to get a good sense of who Captain Harriman is very quickly. You know, you have to sort of deal with Kirk, Chekhov, and Scotty in the movie. You kind of have to deal with Sulu's daughter. And then you sort of jump ahead. Right. Oh, that's fine. You know, there's not much else to say there, I don't think. I think it's just a nice little callback. But then you sort of get into the future parts and you have to deal with, you know, all seven cast members of The Next Generation. You have to deal with Sorin. You know, you're dealing with Lursa and Bator. You're dealing with Guinan. There's a lot of characters here. And I don't know that The Next Generation really translates well into a motion picture because there's too many characters to service. You know, Dr. Crusher really doesn't have anything
to do with
this movie.
I was about to say, I'm trying to remember. I know she was in it, but I'm trying to remember a single thing she did.
I don't know that she did anything.
Yeah. She said her obligatory couple lines.
Troy kind of does something, but doesn't really. Riker doesn't really do much. You know, so Geordi does a little bit, which is basically Geordi gets kidnapped and tortured again. And then, of course, you have Data. And
I know, out of all of the characters they could have given a subplot to, they give it to Data and they give him probably the most embarrassingly bad subplot I've ever seen.
This is, okay, so I talked about how this movie is sort of indicative of a path that the Next Generation movies go on. And Data and the emotion chip and how they use Data in this movie is very indicative of that. I think the other thing that's indicative of that is the way that they use Picard in this movie. But I'll just be very frank with you. You know, we talked at the end of All Good Things about, you know, how we were going to do the Next Generation movies. And, you know, what we were going to do is we're going to intersperse them with the appropriate... We're going to talk about them at the appropriate time in which they were released. So we're not going to
so
be
so no, there was like, we'll do season one of Deep Space Nine, then we do the next Star Trek movie because it was released or whatever.
Than that.
I don't know when the exact... Yeah.
Well, you should.
But I don't.
Yeah, we'll do First Contact like in a year or something. Okay. And then we'll do Insurrection another year, and then we'll do Nemesis. So there's going to be a little bit of time here where you can really sort of think about how bad Generations is. But the thing that really gets me about this movie is that I think that they basically, you know, they complete the work of destroying the character of Data that they started in Descent.
Mm.
I think that the emotion chip is one of the worst ideas.
I thought it was destroyed at the end of that episode.
No, they kept it.
Oh.
Yeah, obviously, because it's here.
Yeah.
The emotion chip, and we talked about this in Descent, but I think it really has to be talked about now because it's actually being used. It shortcuts all of the really good character work that they did with Data in building him up in the previous seven seasons.
Oh yeah.
Data is a jerk.
Yeah.
Essentially. I don't know. I feel like there's a lot of problems here, but you should tell me how you feel about it.
No, it was, number one, I always love seeing Brent Spiner hamming it up. That's always a great waste, that's always a great use of my watching time is to see Data have, to show Brent Spiner showing his range. The scene when he's, with Geordi and he's just laughing all the time, that was obnoxious. He's becoming a really obnoxious character.
Yes.
And, So basically what happened is just he fuses the ship to himself, it malfunctions, it becomes irrevocably, attached to him, and he just has to learn to control his emotions.
Right.
That's the entire plot of that. Like, what's the fucking point?
I get what they're doing. I think that they're trying to use Data in a different way. They're trying to take his character forward. I think that the shortcut here is the shortcut of a lot of what's going on in this movie, which is that they're doing things that don't necessarily make a lot of sense for the character, and I don't think that they're being really true to the character.
Yeah.
You know, emotions don't subsume your personality. You know, I think there's a lot, there's a lot to talk about here, but I think that, if we talk about sort of the theory of personality and the theory of emotions, we've talked a lot about emotions and how they develop.
Yeah.
And again, we've said over and over again that I think we're both on the same page that Data does have emotions. He may not have the physiological response. His heart may not start racing, those kinds of things. But in terms of how he's feeling or how he's processing things, I think that he does have some emotions. And what this movie posits is that suddenly he's getting all those physiological responses. And so he's able to feel fear. He's able to feel laughter. He's able to feel happy, like all of these things. And frankly, I don't buy that Data's personality would change this much just because he can feel those emotions.
Yeah. Like, in other words...
The Data of the show is a nice, thoughtful person, and the Data of this movie is an asshole.
Yeah. And again, what does Data even do other than have reactions to things in this movie? I don't seem to remember him having much of a plot purpose, in a way.
He doesn't. And I think that's part of the problem with the movie.
Yeah, that's definitely the problem with the movie.
They're trying to service the character, and it doesn't have much to do with the plot of the movie.
I mean, this almost, I think about the one where he's, has the conversation about, training Spot, and that's a thing in the episode.
Yeah.
And it's just like, all right, that's a filler subplot. Like, it's stupid. It's horrible. I think, but... Whatever, and maybe that's part of why it feels like an episode, because there's a lot of shitty subplots, shitty B plots in it, that being one of the major ones, but a movie shouldn't have that kind of shit in it.
But again, I think I agree with you a little bit, but I also disagree with you, because I do think that Data's subplot does match up with sort of the idea of getting what you want. is perhaps not what you really want, if that's the theme of the movie, I think, if anything, is that Data has always said that he wants emotions. Now he gets them, and suddenly he doesn't really want them anymore, but he can't get rid of them. So I think that there is a little bit of a resonance there with the overall plot of the movie.
But they don't do it well enough.
Well, that's the problem. It's not done well, and I don't think that Brent Spiner has a good handle on how to play Data with emotions that doesn't make him into a raving lunatic or an asshole.
You know, I want to think back to
this. I don't like Data anymore.
Yeah, oh no, no, I haven't, yeah. I'm thinking back to, now this is season one or season two, when Q basically offers Data emotions and, you know, Data says, no, I'm not earning them. You know, I haven't earned them, you know, that's, and throughout the entire series, there's been that, especially with Data, the concept of earning yourself, you know, and earning your destiny. You know, who you are isn't just handed to you. You have to construct yourself. I think that's been a major theme of the series.
Sure.
And suddenly he's, you know, just going to, pop it in himself and it's going to be fine, you know. Especially, I mean, yeah, I am thinking about, you know, in a way, Kirk's experience in the Nexus suggests that he isn't going to be happy from, you know, settling down. And he likes the hunt. He likes the chase. He likes the, you know, he's really into the idea of I'm going to make her breakfast in bed and I'm going to go and have this grand declaration of how I love her.
Right.
And he's going to, that's going to be great for him, but he doesn't want to actually do the day to day of what it would take to be in a relationship with somebody. And, you know, I guess that's it. This movie could have had a theme of wanting and the hunt versus getting. And, you know, the fact that ultimately, you know, a new toy gets boring after a while. Picard gets bored, you know, realizes this is not going to be enough after a while. Like, yes, for a while, he's going to love being, you know, at Christmas with his family.
Right.
You know, but he recognizes that, yeah, after a while, the flaws are going to show, and this isn't really going to be it. Same with Kirk. Data could have that revelation, and maybe that's part of why Soren is such an ineffective villain, because he really just ignores the movie's lesson. And because I don't think the movie is aware enough of that lesson. It's just kind of a little too buried or convoluted to feel deliberate.
Yeah, it's just, it's not constructed well. And I think that if you look at the way that Data is used throughout the movie, you know, Data is used as sidekick comic relief in a way. And that's not who Data is.
No.
You know, Data has a lot of really terrible lines in this movie. What is it? Like, an oh shit thing? And then,
yeah! My God, that bothered me.
That's the death of the Next Generation right there. The song, the life form song. I mean, there's things about the character of Data that have always been there. He's always a little bit of a ham. He's always a little bit of a person who doesn't really understand how appropriate behavior works a lot of the time. But this movie takes that to an absurd degree. I don't think that anyone would like Data anymore. I think that this movie basically destroys his character.
If this is who Data had been in the series, he would be horrible.
And there are some things to be said. Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And I think that there are some things to be said for, you know, Troy basically telling him, well, look, you need to deal with these emotions.
Yeah.
You have them now. Maybe he's going to integrate them better into his personality, and maybe it's just basically like he's a drunk person right now.
I mean, right now he's a hormonal teenager who everything is very surface. He's the kind of person who, in this episode, he's the kind. Again, I keep saying in this episode. I think that's not insignificant. But in this movie, he's, you know, the kind of person who values emotions above everything. Whatever they're feeling, you have to know. And they have to express their feelings at every single moment, whether or not it's, you know, important or not. Because that's their emotion and that's how they're feeling, you know. And, you know, to a degree, yeah, Troy is trying to say, well, everyone deals with that, but you got to be professional.
Right.
We've seen throughout this entire series, you know, people who are about to freak out at something and, you know, then someone else says, look, no, you got to get this done. And
right. They
suck it up and do it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that, you know, I don't know that this is the right place to tell that story, frankly. I don't know what it adds to the movie. And I don't know. They're very confused about what they want Data to be. I mean, they take Data very seriously throughout the series, and then the movies, again, they treat him as sort of like comic relief. these are very, it's a very generic movie in a way.
Yeah. You know,
there's action. They turn Picard into a fist fighting asshole. They turn Data into comic relief. You know, there's nothing that really sort of signifies the thoughtfulness and the humanity of the best of the Next Generation when it was really at its peak. You know, this really does feel like they're trying to make it appeal to non-fans. And they're not doing a very good job of it. They're making a shitty Next Generation movie, and they're making a shitty action movie.
Yeah, so it's something that, number one, I mean, especially with, you know, we'll talk about the Duras sisters in a second, I guess, but, like, that bit is all for people who've watched the series. Like, that's resolving something that's been going for several seasons. You know, if you're just somebody who's, hey, Star Trek movie, why not? It's Friday night. That part's going to be totally lost on you.
Right. Well, that's why they have the little breast holes.
Ah, so it doesn't really matter. If you're an original series fan, the Kirk stuff, whatever. It's, you know, Kirk is underused in this movie again. Again, if they wanted to make this a fan servicey, Picard and Kirk are fighting the bad guys.
Right.
And they wanted to make a balls out action movie, you know, in the Star Trek franchise, that would be one thing. I could see that movie being an entertaining, fun time. Maybe it wouldn't be as sophisticated as the series could get, but it would be fun at least. Next Generation stuff, again, they're tearing away the characters left and right, and it's just, again, I don't know who this movie was made for.
Well, let me ask a very basic question. Does this movie need to exist?
I don't.
Like, if the Next Generation had ended with all good things and that we never saw the characters again, would that have been okay?
I think it would have, especially because, you know, where it ends on such a... Okay, so usually, you know, on a series or whatever you see as the last image of that person is in your mind what they're doing forever. So at the end of the Next Generation, where the characters are going forever is they're playing poker, they've realize that they are a surrogate family. They realize their close ties to each other. They realize that, you know something, we are going to do our damnedest to stay close to each other because we value this.
Yeah.
And that's where the cast ends. And that was, it was a beautiful moment for them. That's a very nice thing for them to end with, you know.
And you can imagine the adventures they had after the end of the series.
And adventures they had.
Right.
Well, let me, because this movie came out within 6 months of the series ending, right? Like, it was very quick.
Yeah.
When was it filmed?
They basically started filming it directly after All Good Things.
So you could tell, like, in a way, maybe that's kind of it. Like, it feels like this was a movie that was rushed.
Oh, I think it was rushed. I think it absolutely was rushed. And I think that if you even look at some interviews with, like, Brandon Bragg and Robert Moore, they'll say as much. They'll say that they were writing All Good Things and Generations at the same time, and Generations got the short end of the stick on that.
Which, you know, given how good All Good Things is, I'm not upset about that, but...
I think that the larger question here is really, you know, I don't think this movie needs to exist.
I'm never going to watch this again. Yeah.
I don't think there's any reason to watch this movie again. I don't think that there's anything to really redeem it. And I don't think that it's very interesting, frankly. And I think that what it does is it really makes the ending of All Good Things and the entire experience of watching All Good Things and saying goodbye to the cast. And really, that was a good place to leave them, like you said. You know, it was the perfect season. It was the perfect series ender for the Next Generation because nobody left the show. Everyone was still on the ship. You just sort of like things were going to go and they were just going to continue to go off and do their adventures.
Yeah.
And you could just kind of imagine them doing that. And then you get Generations. And of course, this takes place. This would have been the middle of the eighth season.
Mm-hmm.
So you're talking about probably a 6 month.
Yeah.
You know, this All Good Things and 6 months later, this is what they're doing. Why do I care about any of this?
Yeah.
And frankly, I think that, you know, again, a lot of this has to do with, I mean, we haven't really talked about the look of the movie, but I think that there's a lot of problems with the look of the movie, too. I think the ship is way too dark. I think that the changes they made to the bridge are very distracting. you know, I don't even know if you notice that stuff, but like, you know, they put more consoles on the sides. They have people standing there now. Yeah. The entire ship is just very, very dark.
I read that a lot of the darkness had to do with they used the same sets as the TV series. And so that was very much dressed for, you know, it's set up for TV.
Well, doing a movie,
number one, different angles and stuff. The darkness was to compensate for the fact that it looked kind of shitty.
That's what I've heard too. And yeah. I don't buy it.
Okay.
Because... Now, granted, watching the show in the high-definition Blu-ray, it's a different experience because it is a television show from the 80s and early 90s. But it looks pretty good. And I think that there was no reason to make the ship as dark as it is. It's frankly distracting. I think that I watch this movie now, and I'm like, turn some fucking lights on. Like, yeah. what are you doing? Like, it's too dark. The cinematography to me feels like an overcorrection for something that they really shouldn't have been worried about. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I didn't really notice so much of the darkness when I watched it, but, you know, whatever. Because I did like the action sequences in this. I thought that was the best part of the movie. The scene where, you know, the saucer's crashing into this planet. Like, in terms of a, you know, gigantic thing, you know, that you're seeing on the big screen, that was cool. I liked the entire Duras Sisters segment. Like, that I thought was probably the best part
of the
movie.
No, that was great.
Because it was funny. It was a hell of a space battle. It was, you know, it was resolving a plot that,
sure,
you know,
sure.
had been. I like those two characters just because they're horrible, you know, but... Like, I think that was really the scene when they're watching through Geordi's visor and they're making fun of everything was hilarious. But that was the best of this movie.
Well, I think that's really what it is about. You know, if you look at the original series movies and you say, okay, those were necessary in a sense because the show had ended prematurely. There were a lot of different things that they could do with those characters, and they did it. A couple of those movies are better than a couple of other ones.
Yeah.
But on the whole, I think they're all good times. They're all successful movies to a certain degree or another. Maybe not Star Trek V, but, you know, Star Trek V is sort of a noble failure in a sense. I think that if you look at Generations,
at least
and you
Star
say,
Trek V is campily funny at points.
Right.
This like doesn't even have camp to.
No, this movie is 21 years old at this point, and so you look at it and you say, if they had just made, I think it would have been much better. I look at it the way. Okay, this is going to be kind of a weird tangent, but okay. I look at it in the sense of the X-Files movies. You know, the X-Files for the first X-Files movie. Was filmed and released like in the middle of the show's run. And it was this big movie that had all of these resonances about the whole alien conspiracy. And it just wasn't very good.
I saw it in the theaters. I was not an X-Files fan, but I saw it and it was kind of bad. Yeah.
And then you get the second X-Files movie, which took place like 10 years after the show ended or something like that. And it was filmed 10 years after the show ended, and it was just a Monster of the Week movie, and it was quite good. I think what they fell into the trap of thinking that a movie has to be this huge, epic thing, which changes the characters forever, and all of these kinds of things. And no, it doesn't. I think that if they had to come up with a strong story that was just another adventure in the... you know, in the crew of the USS Enterprise D, I think that would have been a hell of a lot better than trying to, you know, say something about the nature of humanity with Data and say something about, like, you know, Picard's feelings about his own mortality and like all of this stuff. And it's just like, this is not the kind of thing that you need to do a movie on. This is something that you can do an episode or a few episodes of a show on because you have room to breathe. You have the time to breathe and really deal with this.
Yeah.
In this movie, you're trying to juggle a plot and you're trying to juggle all this character stuff and you're trying to juggle like the different generations of characters and like how things affect things in different timelines and all this Nexus shit. And it's just they're trying to do too much and not enough at the same time.
Yeah, because they feel like, oh, it's a movie. It's huge. We can do so much more. We can have room to breathe. You don't have to worry about a two-part structure, you know, if you wanted to, you know, and all of that. But that doesn't, you know, mean that it has to be – it feels bloated, I guess. You know, it's not like –
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Because, I mean, if you – again, you look at Wrath of Khan. That doesn't have all these 500 subplots. It doesn't have characters. It's essentially –
it's a very tight movie.
There's Khan, there's Kirk, and it's their battle of wits.
I mean, there's a little bit with like Carol Marcus and her son in there and stuff like that. But
that's still related to, that's all very, very strongly tied to.
Well, that's kind of the thing.
Because that's what Khan's goal is, you know? They're really giving the backstory and fleshing out what Khan's goal is in that movie.
Well, that's really the problem with this movie, I think, is that they don't understand that when you're making a movie, everything that is in the movie needs to relate back to the main plot of the movie. I mean, this is kind of like filmmaking 101, and they don't do that. I think that that's why Soren feels underdeveloped. That's why it feels so weird. That's why Guinan in the movie feels like an afterthought. That's why all this Data stuff feels like an insult and a waste of time.
And again, the
Duras
sisters bit, as much as I like that bit, it's just a diversion. It's just like it's a detour into like a different, more interesting episode of the show.
Yeah, frankly. We didn't talk about the destruction of the ship, though. Like, how do you feel about that?
It wasn't as, I don't know, when the ship, which was the original series movie where the Enterprise is destroyed? Is that?
Three.
That is three. I mean, that is a hell of a scene.
Like, yeah.
That is a emotional scene. It's beautifully filmed. It's, you know, again, as an action sequence, I thought, okay, this is a cool thing. Again, I can see in the big screen, seeing it, you know, crashing through this, like, holy shit, what's happened? You know?
Right.
But it didn't have any resonance. I didn't feel bad for the ship like I did for the original Enterprise.
Interesting.
Like, you know, it's...
Why do you think that is? I mean, do you think you just don't have as much of an emotional attachment to the Enterprise-D?
I don't think they really made a big deal about... Like, the Enterprise-D, I think, in a way, was... means a lot different than the original Enterprise does. I think because you have all of these things in the original series, you know, think about Baylock, you know, we're both very proud of our ship, you know,
right.
Kirk's biggest relationship is with the Enterprise, you know, he is the captain of that. And so when, you know, you see that ship being destroyed in Star Trek III, it's as wrenching as the death of Spock. It's the death of a main character.
Yeah.
In Next Generation, I would say that the Enterprise is just their ship. It's just the location. It's where they live.
Huh.
It's where they work. It's where the show takes place. But the emotional core is in the cast, is in their relationships to each other. And, you know, it doesn't really matter if the ship's destroyed or not because everyone's still alive. And, okay, we'll build a new one.
Right.
You know, I think that was why I didn't really feel, you know, much about the, you know, the destruction of the Enterprise. You know, it's really actually not till we're talking right now that I realize, oh yeah, the Enterprise was destroyed.
Like, yeah.
You know, they at the end, they're just like, oh well, you know, gotta move on, you know, which frankly, given the episodes, given the movie's themes of, you know, moving on and, you know, figuring out what your next step is, you know, you can't really, it really doesn't invite us to grieve for the Enterprise.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, actually.
And so it really does, again, in the light of day thinking about it, it does just seem like, well, we need to get something big in here. Why don't we just destroy the Enterprise? Which is another fucking thing that this, you know, movie didn't really need.
Right. I think, you know, I think a lot of that was driven by the fact that they just wanted to get rid of those sets.
Yeah, which, fine, but...
But you could, you know, build all new sets and say, oh, well, they just refit the damn ship. I mean, that's, you know, they didn't really need to destroy the Enterprise to do that, but whatever. Also, I'm not a huge fan of the replacement ship, but, you know, that was coming anyway. So you... No, there's no spoilers involved there.
No, I figured they would, yeah.
Also, finally, Worf was in this movie.
Was he?
That's all I got to say about that.
What did Worf do in this movie? He just got promoted at the beginning. I totally forgot that. By the way, what the hell happened to Worf and Troy as a thing? Like, they didn't even have one scene together, I don't think.
Did you want them to?
It's not that I wanted to, but it feels like a very big omission because so much, especially in the last few episodes of Next Generation, was made of the fact that, you know, they were dating. I don't even think the two of them walked together anywhere in this movie. Like, you know, you would think that there would have just been a quick scene of, like, he's being promoted, you know, and she kisses him. Like, you know, congratulate. Like, they didn't even have that, you know? And so it's like, I don't know. They didn't know what to do with all of these characters. And maybe that maybe that's it itself, because when you have, in the original series, there's Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, and those are your main characters, with Kirk leading them. And you can really easily have three characters, you know, and juggle them, and then you have these secondary characters around them. Here you have, again, about seven main characters.
Yeah.
You know, each of these different episodes did focus on different ones, but because, you know, because they're trying to cram so much in them, so many of the characters just don't have anything to do.
And that's a problem with the Next Generation movies in general, too. And I think that, you know, one of the things that this makes me realize is how hamstrung this movie is by having to slot into the established timeline. Because I think that this could have been the Next Generation movies in general could have been a lot stronger if they had basically been a way to reinvent the concept of the Next Generation, in a sense, in the same way that the motion picture was reinventing the concept of Star Trek. You know, they're moving it forward a few years. All the characters are in different places. They're not the same.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of have to fill in the gaps. And I think that they can't do that with the Next Generation because Deep Space Nine is on the air. And they can't put everybody 10 or 15 years forward because that's going to make Deep Space Nine and I think at this point Voyager was already in the works. You know, theoretically they could have had a Star Trek series on in 10 or 15 years. And so, you know, you can't do that. And so it doesn't really serve the story. It doesn't really make them tell a really good story, because at the end of the day, all of the good work they did in ending the show and All Good Things is basically undercut by Generations. And they can't do anything different because they're not allowed to do anything different.
I mean, hell, it may have even made more sense to have these be just kind of during the run of the have the Next Gen movies be take place during the run of the series. It's just, this is an adventure that, you know, we didn't see on the, you know, on the show. It's a particularly big one, but we could have, you know, this could have been a season three episode at some point, you know.
I think that would have been really difficult to do. To make the movies feel as big as they needed them to feel and just kind of slot that into it, like season three, I think that would have been very difficult.
I don't know. Yeah, it's I don't know, but this wasn't, you know,
this wasn't the way to go.
No.
Okay.
I did have one really cool moment, though, when you see Soren, like, you know, he's sending a message and like, oh, who did send a message? I recognize Klingon writing immediately.
Oh.
I know. I fucking know. Like, I'm like, oh shit, it's the Klingons. Who is it?
You're turning into a nerd.
I know. It's terrible.
Well, before we tell you what we're covering next week, if you would like to leave a comment about this episode, please do so on the post at trekaboutshow.com for this episode. Please follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/trekaboutshow. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekaboutshow. And of course, as always, leave us a positive iTunes review, especially as next week we enter Star Trek Deep Space Nine by talking about the pilot episode Emissary.
Ooh.
This would be a great opportunity and a great starting point for any new listeners.
If you have friends, tell them.
Yes. We want to make a big deal about this. I think I am very excited to start Deep Space Nine.
I've never seen an episode at this point, so like I know nothing about the series.
Richard is going to be in for a wild ride for the next year and a half.
Yay!
So we will see you next week when we talk about the pilot episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Emissary.